My first job in the United States, because I couldn't get a designing job, was 1940, working for Pat Kelly at NBC on their then-opened international division, which was their first shortwave radio setup of any network, doing the news in German and in English, and then doing simultaneous broadcasts, which... Where, for instance, I did Camel Caravan with Bert Parks, and there'd be three announcers on stage, Bert, and during commercials, we would do quickie little shortwave goodies.
There was Is that right?
Spaniard to South America, and mine went to Germany and Austria and Switzerland.
I'll be darned.
So Bert still sees me and says, man in the booth. To him, I'm the man in the booth.
Man in the booth.
While he was doing the smoke of slower burning camels.
That was an onshore wave, though.
No, we put it on shortwave. We taped it simultaneously with everything announced in German. We had the script in German. And it was the Camel Caravan was Xavier Cugat that early. All the shows, many of the shows were simultaneously broadcast or taped for simultaneously taped by shortwave announcers. And since the commercials, of course, weren't there, you had other announcements during that time, patriotic goodies. But I had to pass, first of all, 1940. John Royal was the man who introduced the international division, out of which grew a thing called Voice of America. And the first Voice of America broadcasters all came out of NBC's international division.
You had an early start. You came to this country in 1940.
1940, yeah.
And already you were working for NBC.
Well, my first job was $38 or $40 a week as a junior staff announcer. That was our scale.
Nevertheless, staff announcer at NBC in New York?
I could have only done so had it not been, you know, speaking German, B, because of the international division which had just been formed. But I had to occasionally sit in a standby studio for 4 hours at a time. I was still a junior staff announcer, and I said such marvelous sentences as WAF New York, or this is the Red Network, or Pall Mall's traditionally fine tobaccos. But you know that there are two announcers around still who were on NBC at the time. Arthur Gary, who's a staff NBC announcer still, and George Putnam, who's out west, was a staff announcer on NBC. And the thing we waited for was a red light that went on, in which case you pushed a button and said, we interrupt this program for a special bulletin or a special announcement. That was the degree. You were given green for announcement, I think, and yellow for bulletin. And that was, you know, hoping it would go on.
I was fascinating. Those days were so formal, weren't they?
Yes. Well, because they were so terribly monitored by everybody, you know, advertising agencies would, and the network would, and I guess the government would, and everybody was scared.
Somehow I say the radio days in New York is much more interesting than the entire broadcast spectrum today, because there were so many different kinds of shows. I mean, there were studio orchestras, there were all these daytime shows, everything was live, so actors would go from one show to another, and everything was live, and now everything's taped, and much of it
glorious
in LA.
We found all the beautiful young gals, and all actresses were waiting to audition. Second floor at NBC, Rockefeller Center, was, you know, sat. One would walk through there on staff. Certainly, I was, 1940, I was 18, 19. I had a certain éclat, I thought, whatever that meant. And I would say, are you waiting to audition? My name is John Weitz. I'm on staff here. I was being paid less than the guides. But do you know who was? Bobby Sarnoff was then running the guides, and some of the chicest men in America were then on the, you know, what do they call it? Guest relations staff.
That's right. Yeah, I think there is a whole history of people who were pages and who went on to be great
people. Champ of the board. Bobby, of course, had a few other. Your name's Sarnoff.
I don't think that happens anymore, does it?
No, and I'm sure Mr. Paley didn't start as a page.
No, he started by owning the network. He started right from the top.
Anyway, his father bought it. 1 year of radio with vast microphones this size, You had those, I'm sure. Not, I mean, 15 years ago, I still did. They had those huge ones.
Big square.
And you, were, you got an NBC pin after 6 months, which was a silver little microphone. That was very nerve-wracking.
Well, radio's boring now. People walk into our studio, you know, and it doesn't look like anything. And there's just some people sitting at desk and typing copy. Well, we could chat all day, but we ought to talk about you. And so what I will do, we'll just continue our chat, and then I will edit it into appropriate broadcast format. On the backs of buses all over town, one sees posters of you and only your name. Exactly, John Weitz, what are you selling?
Well, we're an old, by modern standards, design company, and there are 23 different products made by 60-some manufacturers all over the world, which are produced under our name, to our approval, and very often to our design.
So you're selling John Weitz, the image.
Well, we're selling, I suppose that our company is selling that image. He has nothing to do with me. That John Weitz is the fellow on the backs of the buses. And my kids, when they come home, don't see him. They see me, exactly as people who read books I write see me. That's why the photo on the back of the book is so different from the photo on the back of the bus.
Of course, you developed a reputation for designing men's clothing, but you and your firm had designed so many other things, too. What are some of those things?
Oh, cutlery, a car, but I mean a car end-to-end, not just the interiors. Luggage, an awful lot of things. Anything that I find amusing and that other people feel I can do.
What role do you play in the actual design process?
Directorial one, except occasionally when I find that I can make some contributions, then I do actually take pencil in hand, still design. But very often it's a matter of people submitting things to me and I'll edit and I'll say, I think this might be better or that might be better. Often I'm wrong. Often the house designers are better than I know what they're doing, and I have no complaint about that. I'm after 45 years of design, I'm not that proprietary.
Someone in the newsroom today asked me to complain to you that the John Weitz cigar is no longer available because that person happened to love those cigars. What happened?
They bumped heads with another brand which was terribly well established. And when the market share was not reached, very much like a TV show that doesn't make X number of points, they dumped the brand. And the corporation itself, which is a very huge cigar company, had its own problems. And the last thing they had to worry about was a small specialized brand aimed at young executives, which technically was the aim. And I hope that your friend falls into the category.
Mm. Did you smoke that cigar?
Yeah, I did. I smoked. It's the last thing I smoked. I haven't smoked in 5 years, which shows that the brand hasn't been around for 5 years or thereabouts.
You were born as a Jew to a wealthy family in Berlin. You were educated at private schools in England. You came to the United States in 1940. Your biography is very well known. And while your new book, Friends in High Places, makes passing reference to a degree of anti-Semitism in the United States in the 1950s, where the book opens. Did you, as a Jew coming to this country, run across any degree of anti-Semitism?
What happened is that I guess I seem to be deceiving because I came here out of an old British school with a lot, armed with a lot of American acquaintances who assumed that I was just a perfectly nice German-born, English-educated young man from very good private schools. It never occurred to them that I was Jewish. That didn't fit their prototype. And so what would happen to me is that I found myself in situations where several times along the way people started talking badly about Jews, and I ended up, of course, having to complain about that. I even ended up being barred from a club once because somebody brought me and not knowing that I was Jewish. For some reason, well, I guess the appearance or whatever it is did not make them think of me as a Jew. And so I obviously saw it. It's extraordinary. German friends of mine here, non-Jewish, tell me that occasionally they get anti-Jewish remarks by certain elements in order to please them, which annoys the heck out of them because they hate to be stereotyped as being pleased by anti-Semitic remarks. These are basically minor league things. It's a small-time social anti-Semitism, which doesn't mean much. It is not officially sanctioned. It's not like Nazi anti-Semitism, which was official.
Yes, my perception as just a news person is that anti-Semitism must be very minute in this country.
Well, I think what happens, of course, if you live in New York, since there's a very forceful Jewish population, and since every third or fourth person is Jewish, and since one deals constantly, particularly in the communication media, with terribly bright people who are Jewish, it doesn't occur to one. However, if you do live in the Middle West, if you do live in the Southwest, there are very forceful anti-Semitic elements. There are also nut heaps full of quasi-fascist organizations, which I think are totally ineffective because they have no leadership. And they've got nobody bright running them. Hitler was a very bright man, and he knew exactly what to do, and he had definite appeal. We have nobody like that, and we have no situation that's equivalent.
Wouldn't it seem to you that in these areas in the Midwest and in the West, where there are so few religious or ethnic minorities, that a lot of perceived anti-Semitism, if there is any, is simply due to ignorance?
Of course, exactly as anti-Catholicism existed in many parts of the Northeast. I mean, speak to families in Boston and speak to Catholic families in Boston in their lives, in their grandfather's day. The Kennedys must have suffered somewhere along the line in the earliest days of the Fitzgeralds and the Kennedys. Obviously, there was social ostracism. I find that minor league. I find that annoying, but by no means harmful in the larger sense, whereas the form that it took in Germany was harmful in the larger sense.
You are now a United States citizen, of course. When did you become a citizen?
When I got my commission. You have to be a citizen in order to hold a commission. When I became an American intelligence functionary, I got my citizenship.
I'm sure that you as...
I was nationalized in Maryland. I therefore consider myself a Marylander.
A Marylander.
Yes.
I'm sure that you, as most Americans do, look back to your roots a lot, and that's very apparent in your book. Your case, of course, your roots are in Germany. Are you proud to be of German heritage, or are you embarrassed and angry about the dreadful treatment of the Jews during Nazi Germany?
I'm enormously pleased to have been born in Berlin. It's the city of so many things, after all. It's the country of Goethe, Einstein, of Brecht, Weil, of Thomas Mann. You can't throw away a country that brought us, quote-unquote, Marlene Dietrich. But the fact is that there are marvelous things about Germany, and to be brought up in Germany, to have had infused into one at a very early age the ethic that is Germany at its best is a glorious thing. I think no German, Jewish or otherwise, particularly proud of its history during those last years of Hitler debauch, which of course is shameful and dreadful and inconceivable, although it's very conceivable in retrospect.
Do you sense any feeling of national guilt among the Germans for what their nation did during the war?
No, I don't see how you can do that. Now, you take the average German executive in this city of New York at this point of the game, or in Detroit and Los Angeles, he's a man in his 40s. He was born, say, in 1943 or 4, in the middle of the war. He had absolutely no part in the things that happened. And it's impossible to speak to a young middle-aged executive and say, you are guilty. It cannot be done. You can do so with men in their 70s if they were involved and if they were closely involved. You can also do so, as we should do to ourselves, in situations in which a man knew that bad things were going on but kept saying, there's nothing I can do about it, with the proviso that there is nothing he could do about it. The terrible fact of life is I know right now that there are specific things wrong with certain things in America. For instance, I'm told that Rikers Island is a very tough place and very hard on prisoners. I don't do anything about it. I'm not a great reformer. I hear it. I shrug my shoulders and say, isn't that too bad? I don't run any full-page ads and say, why don't we investigate Rikers Island? I don't go up there to really get the truth. I don't call people and say, tell me what the story is. And if I did, I wouldn't get arrested. It must be understood that by the time 1941 came around, or 42, if a German really did complain, he joined the inmates of a concentration camp he complained about. A great number of Germans did what P. people do everywhere, and that is a fellow, after many years, finally becomes a member of a country club. His company thinks that's wonderful, and he'll make a lot of connections. He's a young lawyer. He'll meet a lot of new clients. And everybody says, isn't that grand? And then somebody says, there's something wrong with that club. It hasn't got any Jewish members. And usually people at that point say to themselves, yeah, that's really terrible. I guess eventually I can do something about it when I've kind of settled in that club a little longer. But they don't resign. They don't say, well, after all these years, as a matter of principle, I'm going to get out of here. They don't. They simply say, well, something will happen. Maybe I'll make it happen. Often it doesn't.
William Manchester, the author, I'm sure you're familiar with much of his work, told me something very interesting before they say microphones. He says he will probably always feel a intense dislike for both Germans and Japanese of his age, although he goes to Japan frequently and in Europe too, and he meets the young people. He doesn't feel, he parallels pretty well what you just said, he doesn't feel this animosity, but when he meets one his age, and he fought in the war himself, he does feel this anger, and he doesn't think this gap will ever be bridged.
I can't feel that. I can feel a great irritation from time to time with somebody of my generation from Germany who tries to shilly-shally around the facts. I feel equal irritation with the Midwestern or West Coast executive who works in a company in which they make fun of the very few Jewish executives who are there. I am bothered by clubs that have, as a membership recommendation, only the fact that people are neither Jewish nor Catholic, and there are quite a few of those that still exist. I find it worse when a terribly nice Catholic Irish family belongs to a club and turns virulently anti-Italian Catholic or anti-Jewish because they have finally achieved the glory of belonging to this club. Whereas the old WASP families have now withdrawn from this club because from their point of view there are too many Irish Catholics in the club. So I've seen this maelstrom constantly, and that irritates me greatly. I cannot feel any bitter hatred for a man who says to me, I'm sorry, I was a U-boat officer. Anyone who has seen Das Boot, which was a recent film, understands that U-boat officers were men who did their duty like anyone else. I know a man, a top-flight German consular official, who was a U-boat officer until he protested so much that he ended up in a concentration camp. He's not going to deny the fact that he was very proud to be a U-boat officer. I have a friend in Japan who was a Pearl Harbor pilot, believe it or not. And he said, we all knew it was wrong. We knew it was a ridiculous, impossible thing to do. But what did we do? We took off from a miserable little aircraft carrier in the middle of a pounding sea, did our job, came back to that little aircraft carrier, flew out again and came back again. And he said, I really cannot count the moralities. I have a friend lawyer who, when I said, what did it feel like since he was a B-24 bomber, bombardier on B-24. What did it feel like to push the button? Said, I don't know, it was far away, it was down there. I understand that. When you're up there, all you do is you say direct hit, and that's what you report back. Direct hit on what?
You were, I believe it was the Office of Strategic Services, right,
yeah,
that you were in, and you helped to liberate Dachau.
No, I was there at the time Dachau was liberated. It was taken by an American infantry division.
Mm-hmm.
Those of us who were assigned to be there for specific jobs, for instance, there were medical officers there. There were big medical problems in the concentration camps. Can you imagine? You free a concentration camp inside tens of thousands of people with tears in their eyes waiting to be let out, and you have to keep them locked up because there's typhus and because you can't release them into the neighborhood. That's incredible. Anyway, I had a specific job to do inside as quickly as possible. And we did it. We had to bring out people, to be exact. There were specific prisoners who were very valuable and very important to us at a very senior level. There was a son of Joseph Stalin's, for instance, who was in one of the concentration camps. There was a famous former Austrian chancellor who was in one. So several of us went in to bring out these specific people, one of whom was a First World War U-boat commander who became Berlin's leading Protestant pastor of the chicest Berlin church, to put it that way. and who ended up being violently anti-Nazi and locked up in a concentration camp. There were a great number of Germans who were extraordinarily anti-Hitler, many of whom admitted that they were totally opportunists at first and who ended up toward the end saying that they were dead wrong, particularly among the officer corps. There were men who risked everything to kill Hitler on the 20th of July, 1944.
Well, not too long ago, you went back to Dachau with your sons. What was that experience like?
Oh, it didn't work. I had been there many times in my life. I had been there, A, when it fell, B, I went back inside Dachau when we were holding SS people there, and I had to do a very short and very unpleasant cover job inside the camp. I had then been back to see it in various guises. When I took the kids, it had turned into a museum. It was sterile. It didn't tell the tale of suffering. I understand that the Russians kept their camps, their concentration camps, their German concentration camps, as they were, so that you could see what a lavatory for 180 people was like, two bowls, not cleansed, but as it was in use, so that you could see what people had scratched onto their poor little bedsteads, four high. It was too much of a debauch for anyone to understand. That first day, for instance, somebody asked me 2 days later what it was like. I had absolutely no idea. You cannot walk past 30,000 bodies and remember them. To me, it was like a movie set.
As you researched friends in high places in Germany, did you have any perception that there could be any kind of rebirth among the radical elements? There are remnants of the Nazi Party still in existence in Germany, aren't there?
Yeah, except that it's such a different Germany. It is not a Germany crunched by a defeat. It's a Germany that's very sure of itself. It's a Germany that is internationally renowned. It's a Germany that has tasted of the bread of capitalism. It's a Germany that is not throttled by its former victors. On the contrary, it's a Germany that very quickly stands up to its former conquerors and says, hold it now. And it hasn't got an Adolf Hitler. Don't forget, too, an awful lot of Germans. That was a very bankrupt policy. They're no fools. They're not anxious to repeat the same gimmick. And a gimmick it ended up being. Nothing. Something didn't work.
Let me... We actually talked longer than I had expected, and I have much more here than I'll ever get on the air, but I did want to ask you a couple of lighter things before you go. Two things, actually. Automobiles are very important in your life. I know.
Well, just, yeah, I'm like most German boys of my generation, I am, I suppose what a modern American would be called an automobile freak.
You were a race car driver at one time.
I raced as an amateur for 10 years all over the world, very much as many years later now Paul Newman does as an amateur.
Well, aren't there a lot of physical risk that ever frightened you as you raced?
Well, when it did, I stopped. But it frightened me no more than a college kid going out on a ski slope. He knows if he gets entered on the college squad in a downhill race, he's liable to hurt himself very badly, but I think you consider that. Or a kid playing polo, or anyone who does anything where you can get hurt badly. I played hockey. I watched my 14-year-old play hockey not long ago. That's fierce, terrifying today, much rougher than when I played it. And there must be many a cracked skull without the helmets.
But no more automobile racing for you?
Oh, no. I collect old, lovely sports racing cars, the kind that I raced. Usually I try to find a car that I did race at some time or other, and I pet them every morning, and I drive them to get the newspapers. And occasionally people out in the Hamptons see me in some 1952 Allard rumbling along at 30 miles an hour.
You don't drive those in Manhattan, do you?
Oh, never. I can't. Yes, I do take an old Ferrari of mine to Manhattan because it's just like a Chevy. It's such a decent, big 12-cylinder car.
You get sideswiped by a checker.
No, I get out of their way. I tell you, the other day I started the car after getting the newspapers in the morning. There was a man my age standing there. And he knocked on the window and said, could you shut off the engine and start it again? I just want to hear it.
One last question. You designed a sports car. I think it was the X600, right?
Yes.
And that debuted in 1979. Mm-hmm. Did you actually, when you designed it, exactly what kind of process was it for you? Did you actually get into the physical aspects?
Oh, sure. You have to design a car, and you design a car. You do the clays. After you do the drawings and the drawing exercises, which are simply a visual, you then end up doing the clays, which give you an outside look at the thing.
Now, what do you mean by clay?
You model a clay, a quarter scale of the real car. You model it in clay. You do a half. Mm-hmm. Then it gets flipped by simply making a mold. Mm-hmm. And then you have the whole car. And if you're a decent, honorable man, you won't have some very snazzy wheels on it. You'll just look at the body. And after the body is all set, then what you do is you do blueprints on it, including all the guesswork. Where really should the engine be in order to balance the car properly? And then you go out and ask for bids. Companies all over the world who build prototype cars, small shops. We found one in England, and we sent them the clay model and the blueprints and sketches, drawings, color schemes, etc., etc. And we bought a Z28 Chevrolet Camaro, which is the power, because it was cheaper to buy the car than to buy the single pieces. Sent it over to England, tore it all apart, started with the engine, and then went about having a car built, all in aluminum. It's an exciting adventure. I commuted on Concorde every month for 3 weekends to watch it being done.
Did you do this to fulfill your own automotive urges, or did you really see that there was going to be an economic market for the car?
I convinced my associates that we would get very involved in a lot of hardware design. And that is actually happening. I think we made it happen. But that a man who says to me, what do you know about designing a refrigerator? How could you know anything about it? Gets taken into the next room where there's a car. Say, if I can design this, I can design a refrigerator. And I made the non-radio right-hand gesture of pointing at a car.
Well, where is the X600?
X600 right now is finally retired after being shown all over the world for a little while in one of my garages, and is on its way to be shown permanently in a very, very fine design school for a year, who thought it would be a good idea to show what can be done by somebody who is basically a fashion designer with a whim to do other things.
But you have no plans to mass produce it?
No, not at all. I'm not in the motor car business. I'm just the designer. What we're selling is design. Nobody's asked me to design a car, by the way. So I think that...
They didn't have to. John Weitz, thank you very much.
Very grateful to you.